KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
If there's no access to food and then there's conflict along with that, the ability for people to even scrounge food is almost impossible.
Cindy McCain, who runs the World Food Program, on how federal cuts will affect the crisis in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
It's Tuesday, May 27th, and this is All Things Considered.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. How Trump supporters in Arizona are feeling about possible cuts to Medicaid.
Sometimes government plays a role in getting people health care, and that's okay. And if you take away that health care, people are going to be angry about it.
Also, a new study shows how the beaks of one species of hummingbird have adapted over time to backyard feeders.
It's a demonstration of how evolution happens, like literally in front of our eyes. And we just need to pay attention to it.
And a farmer in Peru takes on a major energy company in a court battle.
The case could result in a landmark climate ruling this week in Germany.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. A large crowd of hungry people in Gaza swarmed a new site secured by the Israeli military where cardboard boxes stuffed with canned food, pasta, and cooking oil were being handed out for the first time. NPR's Aya Boutraoui reports the chaotic scene comes as Israel continues to block the entry of nearly all goods into Gaza.
This was supposed to be the first rollout of a new plan Israel's imposing on Palestinians in Gaza following nearly 3 months of total blockade and child deaths from malnutrition. Instead, in videos verified by NPR, one of two new fenced-off distribution sites in southern Gaza is shown overrun by large crowds. Contractors of the American company running the Israeli-secured site fled. Hamas says the incident reflects Israel's failure to manage the humanitarian crisis it deliberately created. Israel says its aim is to keep aid from Hamas. UN agencies and humanitarian organizations in Gaza refuse to take part in this plan, saying it politicizes aid. They're calling on Israel to allow them to distribute the aid sitting in warehouses just outside Gaza. Aya Boutraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
Russia and Ukraine are continuing an ongoing prisoner swap in the third and last major part of the exchange. Each side brought home more than 300 military and civilian prisoners. It's a moment of cooperation in an otherwise failed attempt by President Trump to broker a ceasefire between the two sides. Trump appears to be growing ever more frustrated with Russian President Vladimir Putin. In a post on social media, he said the Russian leader is, quote, playing with fire. Latest swap comes just hours after Ukraine's capital Kyiv and other areas of Ukraine were targeted by massive Russian drone and missile strikes. Federal judges temporarily blocked the Trump administration's efforts to end New York City's congestion pricing program that taxes vehicles driving into Manhattan. Temporary restraining order keeps the program alive at least through June 9th. More from NPR's Brian Mann.
State officials in New York say the congestion pricing program launched earlier this year incentivizes mass transit, reduces gridlock, and improves air quality. The Trump administration began trying to kill the program in February, threatening to withhold federal transportation dollars for New York State. Federal Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy has called the program a cash grab. But this latest court order pauses the federal attack on the program. In a statement, New York Governor Kathy Hochul calls the temporary restraining order a massive victory for New York commuters. State officials are hoping to extend the order while the fight over congestion pricing plays out in federal court. Brian Mann, NPR News, New York.
Even as President Trump has pulled back a bit on his timetable for new tariffs against European goods coming into the U.S., he continues to talk tough. Trump saying if no deals reached by July 9th, he'll impose a 50% tariff or import tax on European goods. EU, for its part, has said it's fully committed to having discussions with the U.S. That sent stocks soaring today. The Dow is up 740 points. The Nasdaq rose 461 points. This is NPR. Salesforce says it's agreed to buy cloud data management company Informatica for an approximately $8 billion deal. Informatica helps manage data systems both in the cloud and across company sites to allow for better analysis with clients ranging from Unilever to Toyota. San Francisco-based Salesforce specializes in software that helps sales staff manage customer relations. Both companies' boards have to approve the deal, which is expected to close in early 2027. A manhunt is underway in Arkansas for a former police chief and convicted murderer who escaped a high-security prison over the weekend. Member station KUAF in Fayetteville, Daniel Kuruth reports.
Authorities are still searching for 56-year-old Grant Hardin. The former police chief of Gateway, Arkansas, was serving a 30-year sentence for first-degree murder and an additional 50-year sentence for the rape of a school teacher. Officials say he escaped the North Central Unit prison in Calico Rock, Arkansas, on Sunday afternoon. Video surveillance shows Hardin escaping through a controlled entryway to the prison, wearing what officials describe as a makeshift law enforcement uniform. The Arkansas Department of Corrections says Hardin is considered extremely dangerous. State and local law enforcement are searching vehicles and scouring the area using drones and canine units. For NPR News, I'm Daniel Kuruth.
A couple of border collies in West Virginia take their jobs seriously. The dogs Hercules and Ned make daily patrols at West Virginia's busiest airport, where they're tasked with keeping birds and other wildlife off the runway at Yeager Airport in Charleston, West Virginia. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services, dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG, our purpose is people.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. A war between militants backed by Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo has plunged millions of people into one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world. Even though DRC has struggled with violence and hunger for decades, this year, a group called M23 captured two big Congolese cities. Civilians in eastern Congo are now cut off from electricity, food, and water. The UN's World Food Program says 28 million people face crisis and emergency levels of food insecurity. The program's executive director, Cindy McCain, is in DRC, and she joins us now. Welcome back to All Things Considered.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate you covering this.
Can you tell us some of what you've seen on this trip?
Yes. We've started this morning in Bene, and now I'm in Bunia, as you said. And what I've seen is exactly as you just described. DRC urgently needs to bridge the funding gap. I mean, this is something we can't operate without this. And if we wind up not bridging this gap, about 1.3 million people are at risk of losing their food assistance this summer.
Paint a picture for us, if you would. Are these formalized refugee encampment sites and food distribution points, or is it more dispersed? What have you seen?
It's a lot of things. It's all of the above that you just mentioned. And then, of course, we have some sites where we do cash distributions, where they can buy on the local market. There are situations here where you can do that. And there's other, ways. I mean, there's small encampments kind of pre-described that people just all of a sudden they set up shop, meaning their encampment themselves, and they're not in what we would consider an organized refugee camp or an IDP camp. The bottom line here, though, Ari, I'll be honest with you, is this region needs peace. Peace would be so helpful here. WFP would be able to get in at scale, and other organizations would be too. So all of it is, all of the above is so necessary and so important for this particular region.
I know there have been some U.S.-led peace talks in recent weeks. Have they made any difference, as far as you can tell, on the ground there in DRC?
Well, they're talking about it. And I've met with two governors today, and both governors mentioned the peace talks and the importance of them and the importance of keeping them alive.
And yet, even if peace is reached, food assistance will be necessary. And the U.S. used to be the biggest single provider of aid to the Democratic Republic of Congo. The Trump administration ended that support by gutting USAID. Have you been able to see the impact of those cuts?
Yes. I mean, we've seen the impact of the cuts because one of the things that we use here that is so important in DRC is, of course, UNHAS, our airline. And we're in a situation now, we've got to be able to keep it flying. That's how tight it is. And to be able to keep it in the air, we're going to need $12.5 million before the end.
Oh, so this is not just about distributing flour or rice or medicine. It is about the actual airplanes that get that stuff to remote locations.
Exactly, and get the people that distribute it to remote locations. This airline is life-saving and life-changing in this region, and if it can't continue to fly, then the ability to be able to really support this area is almost devastated from it.
Hmm. Your organization, the WFP, has said it will need to eliminate 25% to 30% of staff, and other humanitarian organizations are also cutting back, while DRC faces not only hunger, but violence and diseases from Mpox to cholera to measles. Are people going to die because of these cuts?
Yes, I can say people will starve to death. Because if there's no access to food and then there's conflict along with that, the ability for people to even scrounge food other places is almost impossible. You know, in situations like this, the various factions that are in here make it very difficult for people to really survive in any fashion. Food security here is regional stability, and the only way we can do that is to be able to get the food in.
I know you're focused right now on your travels in the Democratic Republic of Congo, but as the executive director of the World Food Program, I would also love to ask you one question about Gaza, which is another area of focus for you. Israel has allowed some aid trucks to enter after blockading the territory for almost 3 months. It's not clear how many aid trucks have gone in. The head of the new U.S. and Israel-backed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation just quit, saying it would be impossible to do the job without compromising basic humanitarian principles. What is your reaction to these latest developments?
Well, the fact that there is not a ceasefire, but the fact that there is some aid going in, has caused chaos, and you've seen it. We've all seen it on the news, and we're seeing more of it today. During the height of the ceasefire, WFP was getting in 600 trucks a day with 400 distribution points. And right now they have 2 distribution points on the ground. We are the only agency that can do this and do it at scale and do it right and keep our people safe as well as the people on the ground safe that are in need of the food distributions. I'm hoping that better heads prevail and we will be able to do this as it comes forward. But in the meantime, I pray for the folks on the ground.
Executive Director of the World Food Program, Cindy McCain, speaking with us from Bunia in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Gila County, Arizona, went big for Donald Trump. It backed the president 2-1 in last year's election. The county also relies a lot on Medicaid, the federal health insurance program that Trump's Republican allies in Congress are looking to cut. Well, that makes for some complicated feelings about Medicaid. Noam Levy with our partner KFF Health News reports.
Globe, Arizona is an old copper mining town about 90 miles over the mountains from Phoenix. Down by the former train depot, there's a street festival every month with food trucks and live music. I visited to find out what people in a conservative place like this thought about the Medicaid debate in Washington. House Republicans just advanced a plan to cut more than $700 billion from the safety net program.
Can I interrupt you guys for a second?
Sure.
I'm a healthcare reporter from Washington, D.C.
It wasn't hard to find people who were on Medicaid or knew someone who was. Heather Heisler's husband has relied on the program for years.
We're ranchers, and there's not much money in ranching. Most people think there is, but there isn't.
Heisler was selling crafts at the festival. She says Medicaid was especially helpful after her husband had an accident. A forklift tipped over and part of his left foot was amputated.
If anything happens, he's able to go to the doctor, he's able to go to the emergency room, get medicines.
And if he lost the coverage?
Oh, it would be very bad for him.
GOP lawmakers want to put work requirements on some Medicaid enrollees and make people file more paperwork to prove they're eligible. The result, according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, 10 million people will likely lose Medicaid insurance. In Gila County, close to 4 in 10 residents are on Medicaid and the related Children's Health Insurance Program. That's nearly double what it was 15 years ago.
And a lot of people think that, oh, well, those are the people that aren't working. Not necessarily.
Fernando Shipley runs a State Farm office in town. He's a city council member and former mayor.
If you're a single parent with 2 kids and you're making $20 an hour, you're not making ends meet. You got to pay rent. You got to feed those kids.
The growing importance of Medicaid to places like Globe, Arizona, helps explain why congressional Republicans face so much resistance to their proposed cuts. Bob Ward has been polling for a coalition trying to protect Medicaid. His firm also works for Trump.
There's been a shift in the public's attitude, and particularly, you know, voters on the right, that sometimes government plays a role in getting people health care, and that's okay. And if you take away that health care, people are going to be angry about it.
Back in Globe, I found people who might be okay with some cuts to Medicaid. I met Debbie Cox at her property management office just outside downtown. The squat building is by a McDonald's on a busy road where trucks roll by every few minutes.
Service First Realty. Okay, go ahead.
She was wrapping up some calls on a Friday afternoon.
Would you give me a call next week? Because I need to start and do a walkthrough inspection.
Cox has tenants who rely on Medicaid. And at the domestic violence shelter, where Cox is president of the board, she says staff always look to enroll women and their kids. Still, she has mixed feelings about the program.
It's not that I don't see the need for it. I see the need for it literally on a weekly basis. But I also see a need for revamping it significantly because it's been taken advantage of for so long.
How many people are actually taking advantage of Medicaid and how much waste there is in the program are hotly debated. But to retiree Rick Ewell, the problems feel real. I caught up with him at the Globe Senior Center as he was stacking chairs after lunch.
There's a lot of waste of money not being accounted for, and I think that's a shame.
Downtown at the fair, I talked to David Sander and his wife Linda about Republican plans for Medicaid.
I've heard that they really aren't cutting it. Now, some people want to have more money spent, and they're not going to spend that much, but they're actually not cutting back. That's my understanding.
The Sanders have a neighbor on Medicaid. Linda says the neighbor wouldn't be able to live without the program.
Couldn't afford to have an apartment, make her bills, and survive.
Her fate, and the fate of millions of others who rely on Medicaid, now hang on what Congress decides 2,000 miles away in Washington. In Globe, Arizona, I'm Noam Levy.
And Noam is with our partner, KFF Health News.
So, Mary Louise, did you know the deepest river gorge in the U.S. is not the Grand Canyon?
I did not.
Well, it's not. The Grand Canyon runs about 6,000 feet deep at its deepest points, but Hell's Canyon on the border of Idaho and Oregon gets to almost 8,000 feet deep.
And now I will instruct you, Elsa. It turns out Hell's Canyon is surprisingly young, at least by geologic standards. It's about 2.1 million years old, which makes it way younger than even the newest parts of the Grand Canyon. That is according to a new study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
Scientists went into caves up in the canyon's walls where water once flowed a long time ago. They dated the sediment in those caves and came up with the 2.1 million figure. They believe a giant lake in what is now Idaho drained rapidly, carving the eventual path of the canyon and the Snake River.
And our colleague NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce got to talk to the lead author, Matthew Moore, who told her he personally got interested in the age of Hell's Canyon on a college field trip. And now he said he could email his old professors and say, told you I'd find out.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ilse Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Now, a report about NPR in the news and in court. NPR filed suit this morning against President Trump and other administration officials over his executive order seeking to ban any federal funds going to NPR or PBS. Three Colorado public radio stations joined NPR in the lawsuit. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik is covering all this, and I will note, as with all our coverage of our own network, no corporate officials, no news executives have reviewed our report here. David, hi.
Hey.
On what grounds are NPR and these local stations suing?
So there was this executive order that the president put out on May 1st and then was accompanied by a memo the next day in which essentially he said the coverage on NPR and PBS was biased. And that he was acting to ensure that that would not be subsidized by federal taxpayer money. And the accompanying material made clear that he thought they were biased against the right, that they were woke, they were left-wing propaganda. Choose any epithet that you or denigration that you want that's popular these days in his circles. NPR and the stations are making two arguments in the court filings fundamentally. One is that the president is trying to usurp congressional power and authority to pass laws, to set budgets, to determine where money should be spent and how, and to even set certain kinds of protections for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and public broadcasters in law, the corporation being how money is funneled to public broadcasters like NPR stations. The second, and in some ways more fundamental element, mm-hmm. is that NPR is arguing this is a violation of NPR's free speech protections in the Constitution, that by grounding his executive order in the accusation of bias, he's saying he doesn't like that speech. Those aren't grounds he can act, is their argument.
I mentioned there are three stations, all Colorado stations, that have joined NPR in this suit. What is their role here?
So in a sense, they're very representative. Our CEO Catherine Marr put out a call and said who'd be interested in joining. Three stations from Colorado each joined. One was Colorado Public Radio, effectively a statewide network. One, Aspen Public Radio, reaches predominantly a rural audience. And one, KSUT, was founded by the Native American Ute tribe some decades ago, now serves four federally recognized tribes in the Four Corners area of the American Southwest. Each says they have a lot at stake, that federal funding isn't the majority of their funding, but it's a lifeline to help them keep afloat, to get, yes, NPR programs, but also do important coverage of news and culture that's vital to their listenership there.
Okay, so this is an effort to make clear what the stakes are for local audiences, local communities. The White House has responded. What is it saying?
So a spokesperson told me this morning that the president is acting within his lawful authority to ensure the taxpayer dollars don't go towards funding bias. PBS is not part of this lawsuit, but tells me today it's weighing its options. And interestingly, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting itself, which is technically a private corporation, is not suing over this, but has already sued the president over his efforts to fire three of their five board members. They say he doesn't have the authority to do that.
We've got a little less than a minute left, but just give us the broader context here. The Trump executive order is part of a broader attack on public media, on media writ large. Where do things stand?
Well, there's no money has been frozen yet by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. They say he just doesn't have the standing or power to do that. We'll see what a judge says. Federal Communications Commission is investigating the corporate underwriting spots you hear on this program and others. And there's been, of course, a call from the president's allies in Congress to eliminate all funding for public media. And as you say, it's part of a larger, essentially, assault on the standing and financial grounding of both public media and the media writ large.
Thank you, David.
You bet.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. And elsewhere on the show today, you will hear me questioning our boss, NPR CEO Catherine Marr, about this lawsuit.
All right, the commercial company SpaceX has undertaken another test launch of a giant new rocket that it calls Starship. Starship lifted off just after 7:30 p.m. Eastern time today.
5, 4, 3,
But not everything has been going according to plan. Joining us now to talk about this latest attempt and what is at stake is NPR science correspondent Jeff Brumfiel. Hey, Jeff.
Not according to plan, Elsa.
Okay, so tell us, how is it going so far?
Well, Starship took off from Starbase in Texas, southern Texas. It flew out over the Gulf and separated from this enormous, super heavy booster. Now, on previous launches, that booster's gone back to the launch pad and actually been caught by giant mechanical arms. But this time, they wanted to test some emergency contingency features, so they sent it out over the Gulf. And it's a good thing they did, because the engines did not relight on the booster as expected. Ooh. And the booster appeared to crash into the water. Now, Starship made it into space, but there are some signs that things may not have gone according to plan there either. The ship started out in a very slow tumble, which then sped up. SpaceX said it had sprung a fuel leak, and I was watching it tumble back in above the Indian Ocean. Very, very pretty rainbow colors as it burned up in the atmosphere, but unfortunately not what SpaceX wanted to see.
Right. It sounds pretty, but kind of janky. So would this test be considered a success or a failure or something in between? What do you think?
I'm not sure myself, honestly. I mean, the booster didn't matter. They were testing that to the point of failure anyway. But here's the problem. They had some launches in January and March, with both of which ended up with Starship exploding before it could reach space. Now, SpaceX later said that the problem there was sort of some harmonic response in the first launch. That's just a wicked vibration that actually shook up the engines until they broke. And then in March, there was a hardware failure on a single engine that started a fire on Starship. So by those standards, today's flight was better because they did make it to space. But, you know, I don't think you can call this a success. They made it up, but not back down.
Right. Okay, well, how much was riding on this one launch today?
You know, SpaceX will say, look, this is just a test launch. They do expect failures to happen. And this is how the company works. They iterate, they redesign. But honestly, they should be making more progress on each of these launches. This program is starting to look like it's slipping behind. You know, Starship was supposed to be able to at least orbit the Earth by now. And on this particular flight, the fact they couldn't hit reentry is a big problem because they wanted to test a lot of new experimental heat tiles. And they couldn't do that. So they're kind of further than they were on the last two flights, but they haven't made a lot of progress.
And keep in mind, the guy who owns SpaceX, Elon Musk, he has said that he hopes Starship will carry people to Mars one day, right? So do you think that's going to be happening anytime soon?
You know, SpaceX has talked about sending a Starship without people to Mars as soon as next year, but I don't see how that happens. There's so much they need to work through to get the spacecraft working. In addition to the reentry problems, you know, they have to figure out how to refuel it in space to get the gas on to go to Mars. That's a really formidable challenge. NASA wants Starship to land people on the moon as soon as 2027, and even getting to the moon is starting to look like a pretty tough goal given how things are going. But you never count Elon Musk or SpaceX out. There's a lot of smart people working on this program, and, you know, we'll just have to see what the next launch brings.
Wait and see. That is NPR's Jeff Brumfiel. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Thank you, Elsa.
This is NPR News.
The U.S. and Iran have resumed indirect talks aimed at reaching a new nuclear deal. President Trump said the discussions were productive and that there could be good news soon, but negotiators on both sides have drawn hard lines, especially over Iran's right to enrich uranium. So what is Iran's position, and is there any real chance of an agreement? We'll find out more on the next morning edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Coming up, King Charles addresses the Canadian Parliament in Ottawa.
He warns that Canada faces a critical moment.
This moment is also an incredible opportunity, an opportunity for renewal, an opportunity to think big and to act bigger.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. The Trump administration is asking federal agencies to cancel their remaining contracts with Harvard University. The administration accuses the Ivy League school of anti-Semitism, which Harvard denies. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny tells us the contracts are worth an estimated $100 million.
A letter from the U.S. General Services Administration dated Tuesday tells agencies to review current contracts with Harvard and terminate or find an alternative vendor. The letter asks agencies to submit a list of contracts they have terminated with the university by June 6th. This is in addition to the more than $2 billion the administration has already frozen. Harvard has not yet responded to NPR's request for comment. The school is suing the Trump administration to block the federal funding freeze. The university claims that the administration's moves are unlawful and that the cuts threaten academic freedom and First Amendment rights. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News.
Ukraine's intelligence service is accusing China of supplying materials to Russian military factories, a claim Beijing denies, as NPR's Emily Fang reports. Russia's more than three-year-long assault on Ukraine has escalated this month.
Earlier this year, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky said more than 150 mercenaries from China are fighting on behalf of Russia. Ukraine also captured six soldiers it said were from China. Now Ukraine says it has data purporting to show Chinese parts and equipment going to about 20 Russian military factories. China's foreign ministry flatly rejected this allegation.
That's NPR's Emily Fang. Stocks rallied on Wall Street this afternoon after President Trump postponed a big 50% tariff increase on goods from Europe, agreeing to wait until at least July 9th after speaking with the EU commissioner over the weekend. You're listening to NPR News. The number of mothers with mental health struggles has increased in recent years. NPR's Ritu Chatterjee has more on the study published in JAMA Internal Medicine.
Researchers looked at data from nearly 200,000 mothers of kids under 18 who participated in the National Survey of Children's Health. Mothers reporting excellent mental health declined from 38% in 2016 to 26% in 2023. And mothers who said their mental health was fair or poor increased during this time. Study author Jamie Dar is at Columbia University.
In 2023, this means about 1 in 12 moms are saying they have fair or poor mental health, where back in 2016, it was about 1 in 20. It's a pretty large increase in a relatively short period of time.
Dar says single mothers and those with children on Medicaid reported poorer mental and physical health. Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News.
Well, the city of Berlin wants to host the Summer Olympics again during its 100th anniversary in 2036. Berlin's sports minister presented its bid to re-host the games today in the same stadium where American sprinter Jesse Owens won four gold medals as Germany's Nazis looked on. Officials say they want to make use of existing venues but face opposition from some locals to using popular City Park, saying the bid is still in its early stages. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Mathnasium. Whether students are ahead of the curve or need extra support, Mathnasium's goal is to build confidence through personalized math instruction. Learn more at mathnasium.com. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ilse Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. A German court is set to rule Wednesday, tomorrow, on a groundbreaking climate lawsuit that could set a global precedent. Here are the details. A Peruvian farmer is suing a major energy company, blaming its carbon emissions for climate-related threats to his home in the Andes. The company warns this could open the door to holding all German emitters liable for global climate damage, while environmentalists hail the case as a game changer potentially for corporate accountability. Simeon Tagle reports from Peru.
From his home in a steep verdant Andean valley, a Quechua-speaking semi-subsistence farmer and mountain guide is taking on an energy giant on the other side of the world.
Bueno, la empresa dice que...
We meet Saul Luciano Yuya on his remote 2-acre plot of land, where he lives with his wife, grows corn, wheat and potatoes, and fishes for trout in the local streams. And this is the threat. Huge blocks of ice crash down the side of Palcarajo, a mountain towering more than 20,000 feet in the heart of the Peruvian Andes, which are home to 70% of the world's tropical glaciers.
Y el temor que tenemos, que tengo yo, es que un bloque de la parte alta pueda caer, un bloque gigante puede caer y esto podría desembalsarse, ¿no?
Luciano Luya's home and those of 50,000 other locals are at risk of being washed away in a deluge triggered by a major avalanche from Palcarajo into Palcacocha, a lake of glacial meltwater directly beneath its summit. Thanks to climate change, Palcacocha has swollen to more than 30 times its historic volume.
We're at the lake. It's about 15,000 feet above sea level. The air is very thin. You can really feel the altitude. And on the far side of the lake, high above it, you can see the glacier, just these huge slabs and walls of ice just stretching up into the clouds, out of sight. And it's an absolutely spectacular, sublime sight. And just really very, very strange to think that such a beautiful landscape could potentially be so deadly.
This danger is now at the heart of Luciano Yuya's lawsuit against RWE, Germany's largest power company.
The world is on a journey towards a green future. RWE has already undergone a fundamental transformation.
RWE is now moving into wind and solar power. It promises to be net zero by 2040. But for more than a century, the company burned huge quantities of coal. It questions the danger posed by Palcacocha and argues the climate crisis should be resolved by governments, not in court.
Together, we are leading the way to a green energy world.
Judges in a court in Hamm, in northwestern Germany, near RWE's head office, are due this Wednesday to rule on whether the company should pay about $18,000, roughly 0.5% of the cost of building a flood defense to protect the population below Palcacocha, including in the local city of Huaraz. Lawyers for Luciano Luya argue that since RWE is responsible for 0.5% of global emissions, it should cover that share of the project's cost.
El oleaje que se ha calculado en las simulaciones está muy por encima de 10 metros, está entre 10 metros, 20 metros.
César Porto Carrera is a civil engineer and glacier expert from Huaraz. He says simulations show that a major avalanche into Lake Palcacocha could trigger a wave more than 60 feet high, which would barrel 5,000 feet down a mountain gorge and eventually into the bustling market town where he lives.
It's also a mecca for mountain sports. Adventurers come from around the world here to go trekking, climbing and mountaineering in the mountains around and above the city.
Back at his home, halfway between Palcacocha and Huaraz, Luciano Yuya chats about his father and other retired porters' sense of nostalgia. for how the mountains once used to be, before many glaciers slowly transformed into high-altitude lakes.
Era imposible, ¿no? Aparece entonces demandar una empresa a eso, pero es muy, muy lejano. ¿Será eso posible, no? Cuando empezamos. Pero luego pasaron los meses, conversamos, luego conversamos con la abogada.
Suing a major corporation in the developed world once seemed impossible, says Luciano Iuya. But now, a decade after first launching his legal case with the help of Germanwatch, a campaign group, he is filled with hope. If he wins, it could pave the way for others on the front lines of climate chaos to hold some of the world's richest companies liable for the financial impact. For NPR News, this is Simeon Tagle in the Ancash region of Peru.
Today, King Charles said that Canada is facing unprecedented challenges. The British royal was in Ottawa to open a new session of Parliament, and that was one of several veiled references he made about the relationship between the U.S. and Canada. His visit was widely seen as bolstering Canada's sovereignty amid President Trump's threats to annex the country. NPR's Jackie Northam reports.
It's been nearly five decades since a British royal, Queen Elizabeth, opened Canada's Parliament. King Charles was invited by Canada's new Prime Minister, Mark Carney, to deliver the so-called speech to the throne, outlining the new government's agenda. It's broadly written by the Prime Minister's office, but Charles added personal touches.
As I've said before, every time I come to Canada, a little more of Canada seeps into my bloodstream, and from there, straight to my heart.
The speech comes as relations between the U.S. and Canada are at a low. Charles' visit is seen as a powerful reminder of Canada's sovereignty and underlines a distinct difference in the democracies of the U.S. and Canada. Canada is a constitutional monarchy and the king is the country's head of state. Although Charles never mentions President Trump's name in the speech, there were clear references about the impact and the threat his policies represent. Charles said Canada faces a critical moment.
Democracy, pluralism, the rule of law, self-determination, and freedom are values which Canadians hold dear and ones which the government is determined to protect.
King Charles also noted global trade delivered prosperity to Canada, a veiled dig at the stiff tariffs Trump placed on the country. Trump has also repeatedly threatened to turn Canada into the 51st state. The king said the world is a more dangerous and uncertain place than at any point since the Second World War.
Many Canadians are feeling anxious and worried about the drastically changing world around them. Fundamental change is always unsettling. Yet this moment is also an incredible opportunity, an opportunity for renewal, an opportunity to think big and to act bigger.
And Charles noted at the end of his speech, as Canada's national anthem states, the true north is indeed strong and free. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Every week, a guest draws a card from NPR's wild card deck and answers a big question about their life. Comedian Mike Birbiglia is known for finding funny ways into serious topics. And when writing his newest Netflix special, The Good Life, he was consumed with how to tackle those serious ideas with a child.
My daughter was turning, at the time, 8 years old. She has a lot of questions, and I actually don't know the answers to this level of question, like religion and existence and all these life and death and all these things.
He also discussed his relationship with his parents with Wild Card host Rachel Martin.
What's something your parents taught you to love?
That's really interesting. I have this line in The Good Life, which is, kids don't know a lot, but they absorb everything, you know? So like, if you're kind, they know you're kind. If you're selfish, they know you're selfish. As I've gotten older, I've realized that my mom is so deeply kind to people in this way that I feel like I've not been able to live up to it, but I've at least been able to aspire to it. It's been a certain type of North Star. Mm-hmm. I feel like she's willing to be friends with anyone who wants to be friends.
Yeah.
And so she just has this like cavalcade of friends. She, you know, she'll just be like, Ellen from swim class said this. And I'm like, who's Ellen from swim class? She's like, I just met her like 3 weeks ago. You know, like, Doris from stitching said that. And like, who is Doris from stitching? And like, she's an amazing friend to kind of the planet.
Yeah. Yeah. My mom was like that. We used to joke. My mom would go to Marie Callender's. And she would like make best friends with the woman sitting next to her eating like the Marie Callender's blueberry pie. And all of a sudden she knows her entire life story.
It's got Forrest Gump energy.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Totally.
Like my dad would say in kind of a negative way when I was a kid, he would be like, Mary Jean, you would talk to a doorknob. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And it would be like at her expense. In my mind, I was like, that's pretty good quality.
I mean, do you try to emulate that? You said she's like a North Star. Look, tried to channel that?
Yeah. Like my experience of being a comedian over the course of whatever it is, 23 years of being a comedian is I feel like I've gone everywhere. I've gone to like 47 states. And I find that the thing that you discover about America, if you travel through it, is you go, people are pretty sweet and they're pretty smart and they're pretty like, I find this to be a very compelling country. So many places where you just go, oh, this is, you go to Tulsa and you'll go like, oh my God, those are the coolest people I've ever met. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. You go to Boise, you go, those are the coolest people I've ever met. Like I just find, I think that a little bit of that is like my mom giving to me this idea of just, yeah, just talk to anybody.
Yeah. What about your dad?
My dad, I feel like is a little bit the opposite of that. That specific thing.
You can watch that full conversation by following Wildcard with Rachel Martin on YouTube. Mike Birbiglia's new Netflix special, The Good Life, it's out now.
Support for Wildcard with Rachel Martin comes from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
This is NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. In Colombia, former army soldiers accused of atrocities during the country's guerrilla war are trying to make amends. In fact, some are helping to locate and dig up the remains of innocent civilians executed by the Colombian military. John Otis reports.
In this cemetery in the Colombian city of Neiva, workers are excavating a grave thought to hold the remains of six people. The diggers include forensic experts as well as three former soldiers. One of them is Mario, a former lieutenant colonel who asked to be identified only by his first name for fear of reprisals. Mario was deputy commander of a nearby army base in the early 2000s when the guerrilla war was raging. Back then, Mario tells me, he and other officers came under fierce pressure from the top brass to run up the body count. Failure could derail their careers, while reporting more rebels killed in combat could mean promotions. But the policy led to massive abuses as soldiers rounded up farmers, day laborers, and unemployed teenagers, killed them, and reported them as combat deaths. Mario says that troops under his command were responsible for 63 such homicides. It got totally out of control, Mario admits. These were atrocities that never should have happened. Government investigators determined that during the war, soldiers executed more than 6,400 civilians and presented them as combat kills. Juanita Gobertus heads the Americas Division of Human Rights Watch.
It was certainly one of the most, if not the most, atrocious crime committed during the armed conflict in Colombia.
Now, however, Mario and other former soldiers are trying to atone for their crimes in exchange for leniency from a special court. Colombia's War Crimes Tribunal, which is also investigating atrocities by the guerrillas, was set up under a 2016 peace treaty that ended much of the fighting. Tribunal President Alejandro Ramelli tells NPR that ex-soldiers can avoid prison by telling the truth about the illegal executions, apologizing to relatives of the dead, and providing information on where they might be buried. He says the former soldiers are also getting a stark look at the damage they've done by taking part in the exhumations.
I think the message is very important because it's the first time in Colombia that the criminals are looking for the victims in the cemeteries.
Finding and identifying the dead is extremely difficult. Many were simply dumped in hastily dug mass graves, says Diego Sevilla, who heads the government forensic team in Neiva. An example of the chaos is the gravesite that was thought to hold the remains of six people. However, Sevilla's team has found 12 skulls, meaning that at least 12 people are buried there. All along, relatives of the victims have been closely monitoring the exhumations. Among them is Yolanda Rocha. She says her 15-year-old brother was executed by troops, then dressed up as a guerrilla, and that he might be buried here in the cemetery. She's talked to some of the soldiers who expressed deep regret for killing so many innocents, like her brother. It was very difficult, Rocha says. You want the truth, but it's like opening up an old wound. Similar exhumations with help from ex-soldiers will soon start in other Colombian cemeteries. But after 10 days in Neiva, the forensic team here is wrapping up its work.
Now they're bagging up remains and preparing them for storage so they can eventually be delivered to relatives of the deceased.
Then the team holds a ceremony to honor the dead. Some team members recite poetry. Others solemnly place flowers atop the bags of remains. Finally, Mario, the former army officer whose men killed 63 civilians, steps forward.
Esto no se repita y que sirva de ejemplo
Let's hope this never happens again, he says, because the pain this has caused is immense. For NPR News, I'm John Otis in Neiva, Colombia.
You know hummingbird feeders, like the ones filled with sugar water hanging in people's backyards and windows? Well, a new study suggests one species of hummingbird in California has evolved to get the most from them, adapting to human influence on its habitat and thriving at the same time. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf has more.
Faye Romero spent a lot of her time as an undergraduate at the University of California, Berkeley, measuring dead hummingbirds.
It was literally like dead bird, photo, 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 dead bird, photo, photo, photo.
Anna's hummingbirds, to be exact, some dating back to the 1800s, long before those popular outdoor hummingbird feeders existed. Romero, now a PhD candidate and co-author of the study out this month in the journal Global Change Biology, says the specimens provided a range of beaks to measure over about 10 generations. Those measurements were just one data point of many used to find that Anna's hummingbird beaks changed over time as feeders became more ubiquitous, says Alejandro Rico Guevara, a professor at the University of Washington and senior author on the study.
Very simplified. The bills get longer and they become more slender
in order to get more food from the feeders. The study also found that the beaks of male hummingbirds grew pointier to better fight off competition. And the range of Anna's hummingbirds also changed, spreading from a small pocket in Southern California all the way up into Canada.
Human behavior and human environments have greatly affected the evolution of birds in lots of ways.
Richard Prum is an evolutionary ornithologist at Yale University and was not involved in the study. He says, think of chickens, for example, domesticated from wild jungle fowl, or the common pigeon, also called the rock dove, which originally nested on cliff faces in remote areas.
But of course, that is a lot like a building. So we build buildings, and it turns out we have just provided a huge amount of habitat for nesting rock doves or pigeons.
Prum says he thinks this could be just the beginning of how Anna's hummingbirds change in response to human influence on their habitat. But it's unclear what long-term effects that could have, good or bad. Romero says that's something she's been thinking about during this study, calling it a delicate balance.
They seem to be keeping up, but just because these guys are keeping up doesn't mean that all the other hummingbirds or all the other organisms will keep up.
Rico Guevara says one of the biggest takeaways for him was just how quickly evolution can take place.
It's a demonstration of how evolution happens, like literally in front of our eyes, and we just need to pay attention to it.
It's also a good reminder to refill your bird feeder. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.